Happy Sunday, everybody, and welcome back to our study of 1 Corinthians. Now, we are continuing in Paul's instructions on marriage today. So we started last week with the first six verses of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. We're going to continue picking up in verse 7 today. I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God. One of one kind and one of another. To the married and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry. For it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married, I give this charge. Not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. As God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him, and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. So this whole passage, including what we read last week, and including what we're going to read next week, is built around what we just read there at the end, verse 17. Only let each person lead the life that the Lord has assigned to him, and to which God has called him. This is my rule in all the churches. All right, so our default in life should be to live in whatever marital circumstance the Lord has given us, if we're able. And we're going to see that Paul is going to expand out on this to talk about just life in general in the passage that we look at next week. But for what we've seen already and what we're looking at today in 1 Corinthians 7, Paul is applying this specifically to marriage. Our default is to be in whatever marital circumstance the Lord has given us. All right, so with exceptions, each section of our text breaks down along these two lines. So Paul addresses different kinds of marital status, and for each kind of marital status, he gives the ideal of living in your current state. Right, this is what you're supposed to accomplish in that state. It's almost like this is what the benefit is. This is what the good life in that circumstance looks like. Then he follows that up with exceptions. What might lead you to leave this particular marital circumstance, and how you do that properly, what considerations you weigh in doing that. Now, we saw all of this with marriage already in last week's text. So you look in the first six verses, and what Paul is doing there is he is discouraging married people from acting as if they are not married. Right? That's what the Corinthians want to do. Right? They think it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And Paul says, look, if you're married, don't pretend that you're not married. Right? Because of the temptation to sexual... Well, remember, we said it's not just the temptation to sexual immorality, but because of fornications, right? Each man should have his own wife. Each woman should have her own husband. Don't deprive one another. Each, should give the other conjugal rights. That's the ideal. Each man should have his own wife, meaning sexually. Each woman should have her own husband sexually. If you are living in that marital status, right? So if you are married, that's the ideal for the married life. The exception that he offers, at least there at the beginning, in dealing with sexuality in marriage, was, well, look, here's the norm, regular sex together. The exception is brief periods of abstinence for prayer. And it's, again, he puts these conditions around it. It's something that you do by agreement. It's something that you do for a limited period of time. So this is built in as an exception. Right, now, that's the way that Paul continues to treat marriage throughout the chapter. So we're going to look not just at married couples who are trying to discern whether or not they should be having sex. We're going to look at married couples considering their marriage. We're going to look at unmarried people. We're going to look at widows. Paul's going to look at those who are married to an unbeliever in considering their marital status. All of this, the whole discussion, centers around the gifts of God, right? The life to which God has called a person. And Paul stresses in this passage that different people receive different gifts in this regard. Now, what this means is that this casts everything in a positive light. And I think this is important for us to remember, because when it comes to relationships, we tend to see like the negative side of things. If there's something that we're not satisfied with, or something that we're discouraged about, something that we're anxious about, we tend to see the negative side of things. By framing all of this as a gift, Paul is framing it positively for us. Right? Your situation is never just something that you're settling for. It's something that God has given you, has granted you as a gift. And so that encourages us to be patient and to be content and to start digging around for the blessing, as it were, right? Because if you're living in a situation that God has given you and you're discontent in it, that can indicate a couple of things. It might indicate, Paul encourages us strongly to consider this first. You need to think about whether or not you've accepted your situation as a gift, or if you've just blindly taken it as something intolerable and something that you need to escape. You need some kind of change in your life without first examining your situation in life. Now, it does also encourage us to discernment and to flexibility. Because, again, in all of these situations, Paul is giving us the exceptions, and he's showing us, the signs, as it were. Under what circumstances do you leave a particular, marital situation? And again, that works broadly as well. We'll dig into that next week. I'll try not to preach next week's sermon today as we go along. But when we say that each situation has its ideal and its exceptions, we're not saying that a given situation is ideal over and against all of the other situations. Right? And sometimes people interpret this chapter in that way. Right? Most commonly, Paul is interpreted to say that singleness and celibacy are the ideal, whereas everything else is second best. And that's not what Paul is saying. He does talk up the gift of celibacy. What he's saying is that whatever situation you're in, that situation is good. It's a good situation and not a cause for worry or anxiety. You shouldn't obsess over things like, well, why am I still single? This is intolerable. Or, why did God stick me with this or that person who, maybe it's another believer and you're just having a hard time, or maybe it's an unbeliever and you're having a lot of anxiety over it. Like at the beginning of the chapter, you shouldn't be obsessing over, well, is it a good thing for me to have sex with my spouse? Right. Now, at the same time, Paul is showing us that there are things to look out for that might cause us to reassess our circumstances. So let's go through each of these situations one by one. Again, Paul covers different situations, and he starts with the unmarried and widows, beginning in verse 7. He says, "I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God, one of one kind and one of another. To the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion." All right, so if you find yourself in this circumstance where you are not married for whatever reason, maybe you've never gotten married before, maybe you are a widow or a widower, Paul's advice is remain single if you can. Don't be discontent. Now, what Paul is doing here, by the way, is he is subverting the Corinthians' earlier call for celibacy, because he does encourage celibacy here, but only for the unmarried, and only for those unmarried who have the gift of celibacy. Right? He's not saying, as a universal, all people ought to be celibate, and that's the ideal. Right? That's what the Corinthians have done. They have taken celibacy and made it the universal rule, and made it the universal ideal. It is best for everybody to be celibate. And if you're not celibate, then you're settling into second best. Or maybe even worse. That's not what Paul is saying here. Hey, and you go back and look at what he says. "I wish that all were as I myself am, but each has his own gift from God. One of one kind, one of another." So not everybody has this gift that he's talking about. He says, "To the unmarried and to the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am, but," he's always coming in with a but here, "but if they cannot exercise self-control, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion." So he speaks here of a gift of celibacy. Not everybody has it. And so this ideal that he expresses of the celibate life is meant for those who have received the gift of celibacy and those who are unmarried. Right, so Paul has made all of this highly conditional. So the exception that Paul brings into this. He says they should marry if their passions distract them from holiness in the celibate life. Now, our English translations obscure this a little bit by rendering it "cannot exercise self-control." That "cannot," I'm not sure where they're getting that. It would be more accurate to translate it "do not exercise self-control." It's an indicative verb here. It's not talking about possibilities. It's talking about realities, the way things are. And so he's saying, but if they are not exercising self-control, they should marry. It's better to marry than to burn with passion. This ultimately comes down to the choices that you make rather than the feelings that you feel. Right? Because the gift of celibacy is not stoicism. Right? It doesn't mean that you emotionally have just turned into a stone and you never find anybody attractive. Because, you know, sometimes celibate people, you know, who have the gift of celibacy are attracted to members of the opposite sex. That's normal. That happens. That doesn't mean, right? So if you are living a single life, and you're doing just fine with it, and all of a sudden you see somebody that you're attracted to, that shouldn't trigger an existential crisis for you. You shouldn't say to yourself, "Oh my goodness, I was attracted to another person. I must not really be celibate." No, that's not necessarily what that means. It is ultimately about your choices, what you are doing, and are you able to sustain that? Right. If you find yourself struggling to make righteous choices in that regard, Well, that's probably the red flag, right? That's probably your sign that you don't have the gift of celibacy and that you should seek to marry, or at least consider it, right? This is something that requires us to exercise some discernment. It's not something where, Paul can't sit down and make the decision for you. He can lay out the guidelines for you. But this is ultimately meant as an encouragement, right? If you find yourself in a situation where you are unmarried, dig into that a little bit, right? Don't be in a rush to change that situation. It might be that, first off, automatically it is given to you as a gift for that period of time. Right? If God has put you in that situation, it's given as a gift. So dig into the gift a little bit. Start, poke and prod at it, analyze it a little bit, and ask yourself, is this a life that I can remain holy in? And if it is, don't change it. Right? That's the consideration. Can I sustain holiness in this life that God has given me? If you can, stay there. If you find yourself struggling, that's when you think about leaving. That's when you think about changing your situation in life. Again, that's kind of the schema that Paul is setting out here. You've got the ideal and you've got exceptions. Here's what the good life looks like in those circumstances. Here's when you need to think about changing things. But here's the whole thing. Your first impulse should not be, "Oh, I need to change this." All right, Paul's next instruction is given to those who are married. We read it in verses 10 and 11. To the married, I give this charge, not I, but the Lord. The wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. Right, so this one is laid out pretty simply. Here's the ideal for the marital status of married people. Now, notice earlier in the chapter, at the beginning of the chapter, Paul is talking about sexual relations for married people. He wasn't talking about their marital status at the beginning of the chapter. That's not what's under consideration. Now, here in verses 10 and 11, their marital status is under consideration. Now we might imagine them asking themselves, well, we're married, should we remain married? If you are a married person, Paul says the ideal is stay married, don't divorce. And in fact, well, you look at this passage again. I'll put it back up on the screen. Right, we've been schematizing this in terms of ideals and exceptions. Right, to the married, I give this charge. The wife should not separate from her husband. The husband should not divorce his wife. Is there an exception given to that? A situation in which the wife should separate from her husband and the husband should divorce his wife? There's not one stated explicitly. Right, now we get kind of a fallback position, right, that if a separation or a divorce occurs, then they are to remain unmarried, right? They're not at liberty to remarry someone else, or they should be reconciled to each other, right? But there's not an out given here explicitly in the text. For that, we need to turn our attention to what Paul says. The ESV has put it in parentheses here. Not I, but the Lord. In other words, remaining married, right, not divorcing, is given as a commandment. Paul doesn't give it as a concession. He doesn't give it as a saying. He doesn't give it as advice. He gives this as a command. I give this charge, he says, and he points out, this is not from me. This is the commandment of the Lord himself. The wife should not separate from her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. We find this commandment from the Lord in Mark chapter 10, Now we're going to begin in verse 2, and we'll read through verse 12. And Pharisees came up, and in order to test him, asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away." And Jesus said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this command. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother, and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. And in the house the disciples asked him again about this matter. And he said to them, "Whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." All right, so we find the whole of what Paul commands in this passage, and then some. And in fact, actually, looking back over the passage in Mark, I don't think that Jesus expresses the exception for adultery in that passage. You would have to turn to Matthew for that. But this is where we find, again, husbands and wives should not divorce each other. And if they do divorce, they are not to remarry, at least, you know, not somebody else. Instead, they're to reconcile. Paul doesn't give a whole lot of teaching here in these couple of verses in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, because this is given as a clear-cut command. In fact, we might even see this as a stepping stone into the next section of the text, beginning in verse 12. So let's go ahead and read that together. "To the rest I say, I, not the Lord, that if any brother has a wife who is an unbeliever, and she consents to live with him, he should not divorce her. If any woman has a husband who is an unbeliever, and he consents to live with her, she should not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is made holy because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife is made holy because of her husband. Otherwise your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. God has called you to peace. For how do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife?" All right, so he addresses the rest. And by the rest, he is referring to Christians who are married to non-Christians. And just as with the other circumstances, Paul encourages these Christians to keep what they have. Don't seek to change your circumstance. Right, so in the case of married, you know, Christian couples, it's just given as a commandment. It's not even an option, right? You cannot go looking for other circumstances. It is forbidden to you. Paul likewise encourages here, and he clarifies, "I, not the Lord," because the Lord never himself gives us teachings about a believing man. Or a believing man or woman who is married to an unbelieving spouse. That doesn't mean that Paul is just pulling this out of a hat. He is still speaking with apostolic authority here, right? He is speaking with the authority that the Lord has given him, and he's speaking the will of the Lord. He's just clarifying, this is not something you're going to read in the Gospels. And he says, "Look, if you are in one of these marriages, one of these mixed marriages, stay there." Now, both the ideal and the exception need some explaining here. Because the way that Paul explains the ideal for this kind of marriage might strike us as kind of odd. The ideal for being in this kind of a religiously mixed marriage is that the believing spouse sanctifies or makes holy the unbelieving spouse and the children produced by their marriage. So what does that mean? In what sense is the unbelieving spouse made holy? I want you to think about the way that Paul opened the letter. Right? If you were to go back to chapter 1, verse 2, Paul addresses the letter to, quote, the church of God that is in Corinth, to those sanctified in Christ Jesus, called to be saints. Now, I want you to consider this. Is everyone at the church in Corinth going to be saved? In the sense that we often use the word saved, meaning are they all going to heaven? Is everyone in the Corinthian church saved in that sense? Well, no, of course not. They are called to be saints. That doesn't mean that they're all going to be saints, that they all are saints. It's like with any church, right? You go into the church and there are people there in the church who are not Christians. There are people there who are Christians who will not endure, right? There are those who are floundering in the faith. Right, not all of the church is the church. That probably sounds more cryptic than I really mean it. Whenever Paul addresses the church of God that is in Corinth to those sanctified, and that's the same word here, by the way, those made holy in Christ Jesus. What's he mean there? We can look at it this way. Membership in the church ultimately is a net positive and makes it more likely for a person to answer the call to sainthood. It doesn't mean that you are saved. It means that you're in good circumstances. So in other words, Paul is not just addressing Christians with this letter. He is not saying that marriage to a Christian spouse automatically makes you a Christian, or that it makes you saved if you're an unbeliever. What it means is that you're in good circumstances. Paul's not talking about a status that is static. Here, he's talking about a process that is dynamic. The unbelieving spouse is not sanctified in the sense that he or she is already saved or in a covenant relationship with God. Rather, this person is now in a covenant relationship with a spouse who is him or herself in a covenant relationship with God. So in other words, there's a degree of separation there, but there's also kind of a degree of closeness, a degree of approach. That a family made up purely of unbelievers just does not have, right? Having a believing spouse in the picture is a net positive. And it all comes down to the influence of that believing spouse. It is, in short, exactly the same thing that Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 3 in the first two verses. Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives when they see your respectful and pure conduct. I think that's exactly the sort of thing that Paul is talking about here when he talks about the unbelieving spouse being made holy, being sanctified. The spouse and children become, as it were, candidates for the faith. Their close association with a believer makes it more likely that they themselves will eventually come to faith. There are some parallels that we could look at for this. I'm not going to sink a bunch of time into this. Just one example. Irenaeus considered this teaching to be foreshadowed in the prophet Hosea. You remember Hosea is commissioned by God to marry a prostitute named Gomer. And there's this ensuing drama that is ultimately about God's relationship with his people. But you have to ask yourself, in Hosea's marriage to Gomer, did that marriage sanctify Gomer? It depends on what you mean by sanctify. Again, it doesn't save Gomer, but it puts her in a good situation where ultimately, it's a lot more likely that she will become one of the covenant people of God and will straighten her act up. Most dramatically, it results in, you remember the names of their children, right? One of them was named Not My People, And by the end of that whole drama, God is saying, I will claim Israel as my children. All right, so it is an encouraging story about possibilities. And again, that story foreshadows what Paul is writing about here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, all of these things are taught to encourage believing spouses to remain as they are. Now, why would a believing spouse seek to separate from an unbelieving spouse? When I think even in our circumstances today, we could be sympathetic to that, like why people would think about it, why they would consider it. There might be some anxiety built in about their own spiritual status because of their marriage. Think, for example, of what Paul has said earlier in the letter, like in chapter 5, verses 9 and 10, about how you are not to associate with the sexually immoral, or, you know, with, you know, people of certain types. And, you know, if you're married to an unbeliever, you might be worried that you are too closely associated with an immoral person. Or, for example, what he wrote at the end of chapter 6, you know, where he says, you know, what can I make a member of Christ, you know, a member of a prostitute as well? Right, there's this concern about association among Christians. And we could certainly see a believing spouse having some anxiety about that. Right, talk about association. This is as close as two people can associate. I'm married to this sinful unbeliever. Does that put me at risk? Right, is my spiritual life at stake? Paul's instructions here serve to encourage people in those circumstances. He offers the possibility of positive results that, you know, that the spouse, the unbelieving spouse, and the children can ultimately be saved. All right, so that's the ideal in this circumstance. Now that brings us to the exception. What is the believing spouse? I guess what's the exit here? Particularly, what is the believing spouse supposed to do if the unbelieving spouse wants a divorce? And remember, by the way, divorce was a very simple affair in ancient Rome, much simpler than we have today. A man telling his wife, "You are to leave," was sufficient for divorce in ancient Rome. So what is a Christian to do in such a case? I mean, Paul has just told married couples in the previous passage, don't divorce. So where does that put a believing spouse whenever an unbelieving spouse says you are to leave? Specifically, what does Paul mean in verse 15 when he says that the believing spouse is, quote-unquote, not enslaved? Some take this to be an exception to the rule about remarriage. This is often referred to as the Pauline privilege. The idea is that the believing spouse is no longer bound by the marriage and is free to remarry. All right, and now I understand why that is an attractive view to people, but there are a lot of problems with that view. First off, enslavement is not the language that Paul uses to describe the binding character of marriage. In fact, he almost always uses that word to bind, which is unrelated to slavery. In fact, later in this very chapter, Paul is going to say that spouses are bound together as long as they live. And that binding character is only broken by death, or we learn elsewhere in the scriptures, by infidelity. It's not broken by divorce. Right? Divorce does not loose the bounds of marriage. And Paul again, doesn't talk about marriage in terms of enslavement. Second, this context isn't about remarriage. It's about divorce. Right? The specific prohibition is against divorce. And the commandment of the Lord that Paul cites is not to divorce. It's in regard to this, I think, that Paul says that the believing spouse is not enslaved. That ultimately, right, they have no power to prevent the divorce if the unbelieving spouse wants it. And so Paul is easing their conscience in that regard. Right? Normally, we would consider the divorce itself to be unrighteous, to be terrible, to be a sin. Paul is easing the conscience in that regard. Finally, if it were Paul's intent to permit remarriage here, he could very easily say that explicitly. And in fact, throughout this chapter, he does talk explicitly about the possibilities of marriage and remarriage, particularly in talking about widows. So, I mean, he knows how to talk about remarriage. He does not say anything about remarriage here. Again, instead, what he is doing is seeking to assuage those who are stuck in these terrible circumstances where they're married to an unbeliever and the unbeliever wants to leave. Right? He's not putting them at liberty to remarry. He's telling them, like, don't beat yourself up over the divorce. Now, all in all, and I go, we're talking about subjects that are the source of a lot of division among Christians, right? Very contentious, debatable stuff. In fact, I will be very surprised if I don't get in an argument with somebody. it's just the way that marriage, divorce, and remarriage always goes. Right, anytime it gets brought up, there's an argument about it. So I pray that that everything that I have said here today is in accordance with the scriptures, and that there's not any sort of division over it. I've also lived, so I've been in the churches of Christ for a long time. But despite all of that, right, despite the division that is often brought up around marriage, divorce, and remarriage, and all these topics, everything that Paul is teaching here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is meant as an encouragement, and it's meant to each group of people. Right? We are to be at peace, Paul says. We're not constantly supposed to be just restless about our situation in life. Right, now, Paul is going to talk about that more broadly in next week's text. But we need to recognize in our own relationships, in our own marital status, we should be content with what God has given us. Again, whatever God has given you, dig in and find the blessing. Have you been widowed? Have you never been married before? Are you married to another believer? Are you married to a non-believer? All of these kinds of circumstances can create all kinds of anxieties and second thoughts, right? Cold feet are super, super common. And Paul is encouraging us over and against all of that. Each one of those circumstances can be a blessing in and of itself. If you've never been married before, that's a blessing. So look for the blessing. If you are a widow or a widower, believe it or not, there's a blessing in that. And so dig in and find it. Right? Are you married? Right? There are blessings in that. Right? I certainly hope that we can find those. Those of us who are married. Are you married to an unbeliever? There are blessings there as well. Again, don't get restless about your life because of anxieties. The call this week is that we all be at peace in this way, and that we take courage that God provides us with blessings and benefits that go along with our calling, if only we will accept them for what they are. We invite everyone who is not a follower of Jesus Christ to answer that call. Jesus of Nazareth is the Son of God. He lived among men, lived a perfect life, gave himself as a sacrifice for our sins. He died, was buried, but he rose from the grave on the third day, and he has ascended to the right hand of the Father Almighty. We encourage each person, if you have not become a follower of Jesus, do so. Believe in that good news. Turn away from the life of sin and embrace the life of righteousness. Confess that Jesus is Lord. Be baptized into his death, burial, and resurrection for the remission of your sins. Find a Church of Christ near you. If you're in St. Petersburg, Florida, or the surrounding area, get in contact with us, the 14th Avenue Church of Christ. Right, whichever Church of Christ you go to, right, they will be more than happy, and we will be more than happy, to study this way with you, right, and talking about believing the good news about Jesus, turning away from sin, confessing Jesus' lordship, being baptized. We can help you with all of that. All that remains is to heed the call. But we hope that this has been encouraging to everyone who's heard. We want to thank you for joining us this week, and we look forward to seeing you next week as we finish up 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Until next time, take care. Bye-bye.